And I'm very pleased today to be with Gunther Deichmann. He is originally from Germany, originally a paleontologist from Germany, and he's now an Australian photographer. How's that for the way things change? So Gunther has been in photography for quite a while. He's an author of 12 books. He is a teacher. He teaches workshops in some very interesting places around the world. And he is a master at capturing the essence of a place. And you really have to visit his website and his portfolio to see his work. So, Gunther, thank you for being with us today.
Yeah, good morning from my end of the world. Yeah, and thanks for having me.
Oh, no, glad to. You know, when I saw your work, I just knew you were somebody we had to get on the program. And given our time difference, I mean, it's evening for me on Tuesday, and it's Wednesday morning for you. And you're in Manila, right?
Yeah, I'm in Manila having a nice espresso coffee right now.
Oh, that sounds good. If I had one of those, I'd never go to sleep.
Yeah, you're on tea time now, I guess.
Yeah, I'm going to be on Miller time pretty soon, but I'm going to wait until we're done. So, actually, I don't drink Miller beer, but I'll have a good beer. So, anyhow, Gunther, you've got an interesting story. You started out as basically a scientist, and you're now an artist. How did this come to be? How did you get into photography?
Well, when I left Germany, that's a long, long time ago. I was just early 20. And I decided, I left with one suitcase. I decided to go walkabout, so to speak. And I went to Australia, and I did my paleontology over there. And traveling with a large mining company through the outback in exploration geology, I fell in love with the countryside. So I did bought myself a camera at one point, tried to take images to send home at that stage. And what happened, after a while, I kept looking at these images after they came back from processing. I said, wow, they're not so bad. And then I bought photography magazine and I compared them and I said, well, that's not so bad at all. I'm doing quite good. So it really started all like that. And then a few years later, I made the switch completely. I went to my boss and said to him, I'm resigning. They didn't want to let me go, but I was pretty stern. And then I went from one extreme to the next. And it started really from there.
And so did you start as a commercial photographer or a wedding photographer? And were you working mainly in Alice Springs at the time, or were you in some of the larger cities in Australia?
No, what happened, I was actually based in Darwin. It's right up in the north, Crocodile Dundee country. And I just love the outback. And no, I started sort of a mixed bag. I never got into weddings and any of that. I always very close to nature. Nature has always been my strength in one way or the other. And then, of course, them days, the opportunity was there to work with Australian Aborigines, which you cannot do anymore now. That part is gone. So I developed a very good friendship with them, and I got into areas where they were still around. There were some very remote areas. And, it sort of worked from there. So I've never really gone into commercial. The only commercial work I really did do, I was in Darwin at the time, around 1970s. I was the first one to work with Cibachrome. I was the first Cibachrome lab. So I had to find a way to process my films, which I did. Mostly I shot Kodachrome, but, of course, there were some Ektachromes there. And, of course, after that, I needed to do some printing. And at that time, Cibachrome was very, very strong out there. And I produced them on a bit of a commercial side to earn some additional funds.
So it's interesting. You said that at the time you could work with the Aborigines, but you can't now. What's changed? Is just their culture and the
It's like with everything. It's like if you compare now Myanmar, Myanmar used to call Burma, I sort of draw a very small comparison to that. It's just been open now. And another 5 years, you won't be able to do things anymore like what you used to do, be allowed to do. And now with the Australian Aborigines, it's just a dying, not a dying race, that might be the wrong wording, but it's the culture is just slowly but surely disappearing. It's not anymore what it used to be.
So they're just assimilating into the rest of Australian
society. Yeah, there are some small pockets left deep in Arnhem Land in the northern part of Australia where are still, you know, some Australian Aborigines still live pretty well, like many years ago, but it's almost gone. The culture is really disappearing.
Yeah, that's too bad.
So unfortunately, yeah.
So what kind of things did you learn from photographing people in the outback like that? I mean, well, it was almost, I hate to say primitive culture, but, I mean, they did live off the land, right?
Well, you can call it primitive, yeah. But what I learned for me was how to take care of our environment and only take as much what we'll need. That is their philosophy. And I can go on for hours talking about that. And I think that influenced my life and still is now. I'm very strong in environmental-related issues. I'm a heavy environmentalist. So it really influenced me a lot, having the opportunity to go out with the tribal elders and, for example, collecting roots, but only taking a small part of the tree, not the whole tree like we white men would do. So instead, grabbing the whole, you know, they just take a small portion, put the soil back, and the tree will continuously growing, and they'll go to the next tree and pick up the next piece of root. So taking a small piece instead of taking everything.
So sort of take only photographs and leave only footprints, huh?
Yeah, something like that.
So have you published a lot of the work that you did in those days?
Yeah, I was. I published quite a few books in the earlier stage. My first one was actually on wildlife, very small book, and it was sort of the first publication which came out in the Northern Territory, which is the northern part of Australia. The state is actually called the Northern Territory, and there was a book on wildlife because we have abundant wildlife up there. Absolutely spectacular, from, you know, saltwater crocodiles to massive of birds. And I believe it was one of the very first books which came out of from that part in the world. And then it went from there. Publishers took notice of it, and then I published a couple of other books with publishers. And from there, we went to the next biggest one was Australian Natural Wonders, where I was going around Australia with a publisher, for a publisher, and I spent some 8 months on the road going through all the national parks in Australia.
Oh, boy. That must have been really something.
Oh, yeah, it was fantastic. I really missed these days. It was just my four-wheel drive and myself, and that was it.
So are your books still available?
Well, no. I mean, except for the latest one, which is Journey Through Colour and Time, which I published in 2006. There's still a few copies around, but other than that, all the other books are out of print. I mean, all of this goes back quite a long time.
Yeah, I know. I mean, the publishing business has changed so much. I was reading that, for example, I mean, this is getting off topic a little bit, but cookbooks are still very popular, and they last, I think they keep them on the shelves for like 3-4 months. I mean, the life of them is very short, and when you consider the cost of actually publishing something. But your last book, you said you self-published that?
Yeah, the last one I did by myself, and it almost sent me broke, be quite honest here. Yeah, no, it really did, because I felt like I had to do something. Normally, I do these things 4 to 5, 6 years apart, because I believe I don't want to sort of repeat myself. I don't want to do the same thing. When I bring something out, I like people to look and say, wow, we either didn't know this about him, or this is very different. So I try to keep it at that one. That's why I don't do it all the time. Even exhibitions, for that matter, I don't do them because I want to do an exhibition. I want to do something which is different. And that's always been my aim, which is not easy to do. But, yeah, the last one I did publish myself, and as I said, it almost sent me flying.
Well, now you could publish on, well, I guess you wouldn't want to publish a photo book on Kindle, but, well, I guess you could. Or in the Apple,
iPad.
The iPad, yeah. I'm trying. See, it's late here, so.
Yeah, I actually do my best work when I'm half asleep, so I'm still waking up this morning. So,
okay, that's good. Well, we're probably in about the same place. But yeah, the iBooks author, I think, is pretty interesting and interesting way to share content. We're actually thinking of publishing some things on it for the magazine, but just haven't had a chance to do it yet. So you're an Apple guy, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. True and true, an Apple guy. I think in graphics, I think generally speaking, if you're in the graphic industry, photography industry, I think you need to have an Apple.
Oh, yeah. I agree. It's, you want to have sharp tools, right? And I think it's, when it comes to computing, it's the sharpest tool you can get, particularly in our field. But I don't want to sound like a fanboy here. So you initially published an article with us or shared an article with us, a review of the Panasonic LX100. So you're actually a Panasonic ambassador, right?
Yeah, that happened recently. What happened was actually Panasonic approached me a couple of years ago and sort of it took off from there. Because my philosophy is very simple. I'm not really into this technical stuff. I shoot if my passion is there for the subject or whatever. It's like I don't really care so much about all the knobs and buttons on all these cameras who are coming out every day.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's the art of seeing it. And if you can see it, then you can take it. It's just a matter how you interpret it in one way or the other. So I'm always having that philosophy. And the big cameras, they just got getting heavier and heavier and heavier, and I can produce the same, if not better in some cases, the same results with Micro Four Thirds. So I switched over around about 2 years ago. I made a total switch. I don't own a single Nikon, Canon, or whatever. I don't have them anymore. It's all gone. I'm just purely working with Micro Four Thirds. And I love the optics on the Lumixes.
They make some fantastic lenses for the Micro Four Thirds system.
Oh yeah.
I tried it for a while, and I love the lenses. I mean, they're beautiful, and they're little.
Yeah, that's the thing. You can put a couple in your pocket, and what I really like about it is if you go particular in my type of work, or let's even turn the clock back, if I would have them. Well, I would have to go back with the work with the Australian Aborigines, whatever there's left. You're not pointing a huge, as I call it, artillery piece in somebody's face, and that for me is very important. I like to be close to the person, and that actually shows now in my photography. Since I moved over to Micro Four Thirds, I can do even much, much better with people than I could do before.
Yeah, I've been a big fan of Panasonic for a long time. I had several of their cameras. No, it's going back a few years. It was the FX30, was it? F something 30. It was a all-in-one, had a long zoom on it, flip-out screen in the back. But it was terrible in low light. But and then, and they had another one that was called the LX100. But it was a small camera and it had a Leica branded lens on it. I don't know if you.
No, I can't remember that. I'm fairly new at this at the moment.
This was back probably 2006 or so. But they were great, just great cameras. And personally, I use the Fuji system, but you got me tempted to get that LX100?
It's a really nice piece. It's a really nice piece. It's perfect. You can carry it almost anywhere. It's so small. And it has a really nice range. It has an excellent range. You can cover, particularly for street photography, it's ideal.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I mean, normally I've got I have the X100S, which has a fixed lens on it. And sometimes I miss being able to have a wide lens. And I thought, gee, that could be a perfect thing to take traveling. And so I don't know. You may be costing me some money. Unless I can get your Panasonic discount.
Yeah, I will talk to them. No problem.
Yeah, fat chance with that. So, I don't know. Gee, you've done so much. I mean, what do you think what's your best work that you've ever done, or what you're most proud of?
The one I'm going to do tomorrow.
All right. I like that. Never look back, not even in the rearview mirror.
No, it's actually very funny. I know I've got some very nice work there, but I get very, very quickly bored of it. That's myself, mind you. Other people, not. They're looking to say, oh, wow, this is great. But I already put it behind me, and I'm always looking forward to the next. And then I get excited maybe for a couple of weeks, and then the next one comes up. But it always has been like that with me.
I think that's pretty common with creative people in general.
Yeah, I guess so. But it's really, even my editing, sometimes when I work on a project, I always bring in other people to help with the editing. Because I maybe get my emotions too much involved, and I don't like that. So in a serious project, I mean, I do my own editing, of course, but when it gets serious, like I do a book, or when I did my book, Journey Through Color and Time, I had a very good creative director. I had a couple of other people looking at it, and sort of, it's, I think, very important. A lot of people, a lot of photographers out there don't do that, and I think they should, particularly when it gets serious.
When you talk about editing, do you mean making the selections for the book?
Correct.
And how do you do that?
Well, these days, I mean, I have my film images, they're all scanned, they're all digitized. So if I would have to put a book together tomorrow, say the best of or something, I would just bring them up in Aperture or Lightroom, whatever software is available. There's a lot of good tools now. You can do relatively quick on a computer. And you go from there. And I do my editing there. And then you just have to lock yourself away with a glass of wine maybe, or some, with a good coffee machine, and then off you go. And it doesn't happen overnight. You got to keep going back and forth. So you maybe have a selection of 1,000 or 2,000 images, and you only can end up, you can only have 100. That's a tough one. And then you've got to keep coming back until you decide in the end, with the help of some people from the industry, that's the take in the end. You end up with 100.
Yeah, that's what I wonder, just paring it down and leaving things aside because you've got a lot of good work there, and I just wondered, what the decision process is, or is it more of a gut feel?
Well, it's two things. If there's definitely a gut feel, get outsiders involved, and particularly when you do a book, you have opposite pages, so you've got to be careful what you put on the other side. You've got to make sure that the color fits. Not that it becomes a clash of the titans and then one brings down the other or the other way around. So it's not only the great images you're selecting, but they always have to work color-wise. And if particularly you're dealing with color, and black and white is not so critical, but if you're dealing with color, you have to be careful that the opposite is, definitely complements. It's complementing. And repetitive is one of the hardest ones. You have a great shot, and you have a great shot, but if it's two sunsets next to each other, that's already a no-no for me. So you have to decide. You have 100 sunsets, only one can go in, sort of.
Yeah, that makes sense.
it's not easy sometimes. It's never easy.
I was talking to somebody once, I don't remember who it was, but they had published several books, and they would actually print the photos out and lay them on the floor and just keep going through them and, you know, setting some aside and putting them together, probably for, like you said, when you got facing pages and things. But I don't know, it seems so tough. I mean, I have a hard time just choosing one. Well, I have a hard time finding good ones to keep. I don't think I have your problem where you've got too many good ones. But have you ever worked with somebody and you have photos that maybe you didn't even want to keep or you were going to throw away, and they looked at it and said, wow, this is great. We need to use this one.
Oh, yeah. That happened in my last book. There was I had a lot of arguments. It was a good friend, René Olbès, very, very well known creative director, very creative person. And he gave me hell, actually, at one point and saying, no, Gunther, this has got to go. And I said, no, that's got to go in. So it went back and forth. We had a ping pong game. But in the end, I had to sort of agree with him, even if I didn't like it. But he made his point, and we discussed it. And in the end, well, many cases, the one he picked ended up being in the book. So it's a tricky one from my personal, because I have my emotions involved, because I was there when I took the image. So maybe my lens cap fell down during that very moment. And the problem is I have memories attached to it, or maybe I fell over or almost fell over. And sort of these things are still in the back of my mind, and they're coming to play. And you need to get rid of that. You're going to be ice cold when you do the editing.
Yeah, yeah, you do. But, I mean, how do you tear yourself away from it? Because they are your babies.
Yeah, you just have to do it. I guess you just have to be really super tough on yourself and make no compromises.
So what does somebody like René add to the mix? I mean, what do they bring to it that you don't have? Objectivity?
Yeah, it's like, look, for example, you have two images and you look at them and you say, well, look, why do you want to put that one in there? And I said, yeah, because it's really great. And he says, no, look at this one. This is much better. It tells me more. So maybe I missed something. And he sees something which I didn't see. So it's, again, like I pointed out, it's extremely important. If you do a project and you want to make it work, if it's a book or whatever, even for magazine articles, that you really do the editing. Do it yourself first, cut it down to a certain number, and then bring somebody else in. I think without that, you cannot do it.
Speaking of projects, we have a lot of people who want to submit projects to the magazine, or they just want to work on a project of their own, and they don't know where to start or don't know how to continue. What kind of advice would you give somebody who wants to, you know, they've got an idea and they want to start a project, but what advice would you give them to help them get through it to the end, if there is ever an end?
Well, it's like this, actually. Very important, particularly in this age where we have electronics and there's some surplus of images floating in the web. You get flooded with really good ones, but you get flooded also with very bad images. You need to really have a theme. You got to nail that down, and then you got to stick with that. And then you got to do what I keep saying, or even telling my students, research, research, and even more research.
And speaking of students, you spend a lot of time teaching. You teach workshops in some very interesting places. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah, I take small groups into either to India or Myanmar, Burma, all over the place, particularly Asia. So it's very close for me to reach these places, and I have a very good idea what's going on. I usually have people, some good guides on the ground. Yeah, so I set up these workshops, and these are not local. I mean, they're from an international. I advertise that primarily over the web, and we go between 8 or 10 maximum, and we go like into Myanmar. Usually most of these workshops running for 10, 14 days, and there's sometimes an extension. Somebody wants to spend another week there, we can arrange that. and we go. But I'm not teaching so much about the aperture, shutter speed, and what button or knob to dial. Mm. I'm more of the philosophy of it, of learning how to see. And actually, I keep coming back to that, the art of seeing. Not just bluntly shooting everything what's in front of you. Take example, like when we go to Angkor Wat, the first thing somebody would do, or newbies would, to see this beautiful ancient building in front of them, and they storm right into it instead of sitting back for maybe half an hour and taking in the view from a distance and appreciating what mankind did a long time ago without tools, and then working it slowly. So I'm more into that. And what we do also, we go out very early in the morning, then we usually have a break around 10:30, 11. We go back to our hotel, and then after that, we have time to do a bit of editing, download our images these days, do our editing, and then we go out at 3 o'clock again.
So you're inside during the bad light, huh? Not
yeah.
The bad light, the harsh light, whatever.
Yeah, no, we avoid that because my favorite sign is photography is light, light is photography. That's actually my philosophy, and that's actually all it boils down to. It's nothing to do. Everything's got to do with light.
Yeah, I was watching on public television here in the U.S. There was a series about photographers, and I wish I could remember the guy's name. He was a National Geographic photographer, and he was shooting in like Wyoming at a rodeo. And he said, you know, I always wait, you know, for the sweet light. He said, you know, my mother could take great pictures in this light. And he was shooting in this rodeo, and the sun was low in the sky, and he was capturing all these great images. And I guess that's so true, you know. And it seems like when most people are traveling, you know, they're eating breakfast in the morning or they're eating dinner in the evening, so they're out at noon or 1 o'clock or whatever, and not the best time to be taking photographs.
Yeah, and I mean, in Sri Lanka, for example, there's not even time for breakfast. There's one location which I scouted out many years ago. We have to leave our hotel around 2:30 in the morning, and then it's about a two-hour drive to the location to catch the sunrise. And then we go back. So, but if we can get back to the hotel around 8 o'clock and have breakfast then.
yeah, take an energy bar with you.
Yeah.
I heard a quote from somebody, I forget who it was. Boy, my memory is just terrible this evening. It was a woman, and someone asked her, what's the best piece of photography equipment I should get? And she says, an alarm clock. Good idea. So how often do you do these workshops?
It depends. If I can fill them up, usually, I mean, I had 1 year we had about 4 to 5. Sometimes it's 2, but it's an average between 2 and 3 a year.
Hmm. And do you take care of all the travel arrangements too, or are people on board for that?
No, the only thing I do, basically, everything on the ground or for that particular location, I take care of. But they have to take care of their international affairs, of course.
Sure. So it's basically you say, show up here on this day, and we'll take it from there.
Yeah, we get them picked up at the airport, and then we go.
And do people bring their spouses along, too, who maybe aren't interested in photography?
Well, it happened a couple of times, but so far that went okay. The spouses that did come along, they were quite good, no problems, so there was no interference. Sometimes it does happen, and I take that. It's okay. I can understand that. So, yeah, occasionally they do bring the wife or the husband or the other way around. So it's I allow that. So I'm not that tough.
Yeah, that's good. So somebody who works with you, what can they expect to walk away with in terms of learning or whatever?
Well, again, it really depends how much effort each individual puts in himself. How much do they want to learn? Number one, I'm there. I'm an open book. I'm ready 24/7. I can help them with anything possible. So the thing is, I had cases where I have seen an incredible increase in their imagery, where before they're joined. Some of them, I have a lot of returnees on my dad, so a lot of them come with me not only once. They want to go on to the next one. I enjoyed it so much. But I can see their improvement incredibly. So just learning how, showing them how to see and holding back, and as I keep saying, their improvement is quite drastic in some cases. Well, of course, we had also some others which didn't sink in much. But the majority, I would say 85%, walk away with a much better idea how to see and how to approach the subject, if it's people, if it's landscape, or even generally how to deal with light. Because we do have some sessions, particularly in Cambodia, where I really push them very hard. And some of the returnees keep calling them Gunther's or Gigi's boot camp. Cambodia is quite famous for that. So I put them through mud and rain, and I love shooting in the rain. I love shooting in the off season. And everybody keeps asking me, well, why do we go this time of year? It's the rainy season. I said, well, you wait and see. But the thing is, what I like about that part, everybody normally goes from the nice blue sky and it's boring.
Yeah.
So we actually make it challenging, and you can create some amazing images during the rainy season.
No, I think that's a good idea. And, well, you know, when everything's wet, you know, it's, you know, colors are more saturated, and you don't have that harsh light. That makes a whole lot of sense. So what's the biggest challenge you face in teaching workshops like this?
The mixed bag of people, which you get different nationalities, you get different tastes and food, you get different expectations. Some people don't mind having a hotel room, which is not maybe 150%. Others really put a lot of importance on that. So it's more or less like the biggest challenge is always making it work amongst the participants, that we all end up having a good time and having a good laugh at the end of each and every day.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And we have, in the end of the day, they spend money. They're going. It's pretty much their vacation in one way or the other. And photography is their hobby, or they want to take it a bit more serious. So I believe you got to have a good time at the same time. You can't have it always too serious. And I make it very loose, and not just strictly, now you go to school and from 8 to 5 and that's it. No, we have a really good time. I mean, we have so many laughs, and I think in the end of the day, that is the key. We should have fun.
So who... So do you have any students who've really been standouts that, you know, have really gone to the next level as a result of working with you, or even just, you know, in terms of their photography in general? I mean, anybody you would recommend saying, don't miss this person. They were a student of mine, and I can't believe the work they do.
Yeah, there's a couple of them come to mind. One in particular is Hubert Weber, a Swiss guy. And from way back, he, you know, when he started the first workshop with me, I mean, I can see now he's producing some extraordinary images now. Very, very nice. So I can see already, and it makes me, I feel satisfied. It makes me happy. So I can turn around and say, well, was somebody who really listened to it, and it took my advice. And even though at times they didn't like it, but he went all the way, and I can see the results now. Because during these workshops, I have a few days where you might call they don't like me at all, but it's only for 2 days. And one day is usually when everybody hates me, when I tell them, okay, tomorrow morning we go out, and you're only allowed to bring your 50mm lens. And then it comes the oohs and ahs and said, no, we can't do that. I said, yes, you can. Otherwise, you have to stay in the hotel. And the other day, I usually take them out and say, well, today you cannot use your LCD. And if you do use it or don't turn it off, I tape it up. So But these 2 days, usually, I'm not very popular, believe me. But at the end of the workshop, it's usually the first or the second or third day, and I do that. But at the end, they all come up to me and saying, wow, I'm going to buy a 50mm lens now if they only had a zoom lens. If they have a zoom lens, they can't actually get the 50, I tape it up. So they can only shoot at that 50, right, finish. But at the end of the workshop, they always come up to me and say, wow, this is the best thing we did. Now, they either go out and buy a 50 if they didn't have one, or they actually go shoot without looking at the LCD. And that is everything to do with learning to understand light. Because you can't keep looking at that LCD, because by the time you shoot and the image is created, you can't make adjustment, because whatever happens a second or a split second before, it's gone. So you either get it or you don't. And that is what I'm trying to get across to them.
Yeah, why bother? You're right. Stop chimping already, huh?
Yeah. So that is the 2 days where I said I'm not that popular. So it's... But in the end, it really comes good.
Yeah, I imagine chemistry among the group is really important. Did people wind up leaving your workshops and being friends forever after that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's a lot of cases that happen, and it's still happening now.
Yeah, because you go through so much with a small group of people in a strange place. I would imagine they get pretty close, or else they wind up killing each other. But no.
No, not so bad. But sometimes their disagreements has come, but they usually solves itself very quickly.
So what's been your biggest takeaway from teaching?
Well, my biggest takeaway, I guess I can travel, which I love doing, and I can do it more. I don't have to wait actually for assignments. It's becoming sort of an assignment. I've done a couple of jobs workshops which I then stayed on in that particular location and produced some stories like I did in Sri Lanka, which I photographed the Moonstone Mine, which I discovered while I was over there. And when everybody left, I then tackled that project. So these sort of are the takeaways I get from that.
Wow. Boy, I tell you, there's a lot of people would just love to have your life. I mean, that sounds really cool. And I think it'd be great to go on a trip with you sometime.
You're most welcome. Join me anytime you like.
Oh, I'd love to. I've got to convince Mrs. Street Photography Magazine to come with me.
Okay.
That's another story. Hey, let's talk about some of your photos. I look through your portfolios, and it's just like there's just one beautiful photo after another. I guess this is what you get for just doing this all the time. Oh, yeah, I do have another question. I mean, travel photography. You go to a new place, and it can be overwhelming. And I can imagine, I've never been to India, but I can imagine if you've gone there for the first time, it's got to be really overwhelming.
Well, the thing is like this. A lot of people, I hear this a lot. They don't want to go to India anymore, or they don't want to go to Cambodia again. They say, oh, I've been there. I've been in this country. I don't need to go back there, which is the wrong attitude to take. For the very simple reason, I've been going to Cambodia for the last 20-plus years, and I still go there tomorrow, the next day, and the day after. It is only after many visits, return visits, you get to understand and learn the country. And I think the second or third time around, you go there, you will get incredible images. Not the first time around. Myanmar is the same. Very overwhelming. But the second time around, you can pull out, or third time around, you get much, much better images than the first time around. The same as India. India is totally crazy when it comes to color. You got to really have a discipline. That's why... Since I've been going there, even for myself, prior my workshops, I'm very laid back usually. I don't get that excited. I'm very cool. And I got to calm everybody down. I said, look, slowly, 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 there's plenty more of this. You know. So, yes, it can get very overwhelming. There's so much to shoot, particularly in the streets of India and the back streets. And I go the back streets. I usually go places where the tourists don't go.
Yeah, that's always my favorite when I travel. Just to avoid the tourist locations like the plague. But looking at your photos here, I mean, you've got so many great ones. And at your suggestion, I looked at focusing on a couple of the galleries. And I guess one of my favorites, and I just keep coming back to this one, and the name, well, when I hover over the link, it's called In the Streets at the Ghats
in Vierendon.
Yeah, it's a photo of a man on the right side of the frame, and a woman walking out of the frame on the left. It's one of the links that I provided to you. I don't know if you know which photo I'm talking about.
I know Vierendon quite well. What is the color in that?
Oh, orange.
Orange.
Yeah, the man is wearing orange clothes, and the lady has an orange sari on. And he's got a little cup in front of him. And it would be... all three of these photos are from the same gallery. I've just, forgive me for a minute here. I mean, I can, so the link picked up the...
I see it now. I have it here. You sent me the link. I'm looking at it right now. Yeah, I know. It's one of my favorites, too. Actually, I like it very much, too. You picked a nice one.
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, like I said, they're all good, but just, I mean, of course, you probably don't even think about this, but I mean, the exposure is just perfect. The, you know, I mean, he's in the shadows, but, you know, it's perfect. And I'm sure you don't even think about capturing and, you know, what you're going to do to capture a photo like this, but... No, I'm just interested in this. I mean, if you recall even taking the shot.
Oh, yeah. I can remember it very well, actually. It's only happened, actually, last year.
Oh.
Yeah, it's fairly new.
And can you tell us anything about what was going on? Or?
Yeah, I was. We were actually there with a group, and sort of I walked a little bit away, and what happened was I come across this guy, a sadhu, and obviously he was sitting there and asking for a donation or whatever you want to call it. And I went, you know, it's not always eye level. I always have to point this out to my students even. You don't always shoot at eye level. Why don't you start squatting down? It's good exercise to start off with. And then not always shooting it from the eye level. So instead looking down on him. So what I did in this case, I saw him. I squatted down and people coming, I can hear people coming from behind me passing by. And this one woman, there was a couple of guys in front of him, but I had to time it that I didn't want to get these other people in. And as she walked along, I caught one glimpse of her as she turned around. And you can see that very clearly, actually, but it's only one frame. So you have to be ready for that. And I think the Lumix or the smaller camera actually made a huge difference here. I mean, I guess you could have shot it with the DSLR too, but I noticed that people are much more comfortable in front of the camera, even if they're generally camera shy. They either don't take it too serious or whatever it might be, but it's I get much closer. I get really deeper into it by using a small camera. And I think this is one of the cases where a Leica or the Lumix really made a difference.
What lens would you have used on this? Looks like
this one probably would have used the 40 on this one.
Mm-hmm.
It's the 20 equivalent to 40.
Yeah.
A lot of these things I shoot with that lens. It's a great lens, the Mill Pancake lens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just the Panasonic 20?
Yeah, that's equivalent to 40.
Yeah, I used to have that lens. There's another photo, another one I really like. It's in the same group, and it's a photograph of some clothes hanging on a clothesline in front of a very colorful wall.
Okay, the underwear, the washing.
Yeah.
That is things which I enjoy always doing. I've done it. I like graphics, and I guess that comes my strong graphic element in the images. You might notice that all the way throughout in the strong colors. I think that derived from my work and my friendship with the famous Pete Turner from New York, who I had happened to work with many years ago in Australia. And we became good friends. We're still in contact now. Pete is getting a bit older now. But I always look for some graphic elements. And particularly if you want to tell a story maybe later on from a particular place, you need these type of images. You can't just have this sadhu there with the woman. Yeah, that's one image. But you need to have other images too, which are graphic elements or showing the daily life without a person. And in this case, I found it very interesting. First of all, the color drags me in, the washing, and that's how life is in that part of the world.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I mean, it just gives you a real slice of what it's like there.
Right.
And it's just some clothes. But yeah, you're right. I mean, the... The graphical elements really pull you into this. You know, I saw this in a thumbnail, and I went right to it. You know, a lot of photos, if you're just looking at the thumbnail, you go right past it. But that, and actually, all of yours are like that. Let's see. Let's go to here's another one. This was in Myanmar, and it's Ubin Bridge. Ubin Bridge, yes. And a group of people in pink.
Buddhist nuns. They usually dress pink in Myanmar. Mm-hmm. The females or the nuns wearing pinkish gowns, where the monks wear on the orange or deep maroon.
Well, this is a group of nuns on this bridge, and it's shot in it's a portrait orientation,
right?
And so you know the photo I'm talking about.
Yes, I know the photograph you're talking about.
And so, what can you tell us about this one?
Well, we were on the boat, and again, when you're on the boat, it's like you don't have much room to maneuver around. You're stuck one way or the other, even though you can paddle a little bit back and forth, but. I usually try to anchor myself in one area and let life... My philosophy is always let it come to me. I don't shoot just blindly. I usually let it come to me. This is one of my very favorite saying, and I apply that almost to everything. I'm not disappointed if I don't get it. Then there'll be another day, and there'll be another day. But I usually let things come to me. And I believe this or not, 99% of the time, it usually comes to me. And in this particular case, the hardest part was there was a lot of traffic on that bridge. So the isolation, again, to keep all the – I mean, there are obviously some tourists walking across the bridge. So I was waiting and waiting and waiting until they came out of the frame. Or walked out of the frame on that bridge, so I concentrated on that group. And I kept really focusing on that group until the tourists sort of passed and other people didn't look so good. And I managed to isolate just the nuns, and at that very moment, I had a bird flying into it. Okay, that's the lucky part. You know, we get lucky too sometimes. So at the right time, where others maybe just keep shooting and veering away, maybe on the left, maybe shooting on the right, and then when the moment comes, they miss the actual real image, which was there all the time, but they didn't wait. Okay, it could have happened. I couldn't have got the shot if somebody else would have walked in. Okay, then I would have waited. Maybe the next day, maybe I would have got it then. So I'm never that disappointed if I don't get it, because... as I said, I let it come to me. And usually when it comes to you, it's usually that's what you want.
So do you shoot a lot? I mean, when you're out?
I used to shoot a lot more, yeah. But I shoot a lot less now. Okay. A lot less now.
I kind of figured that was the case. And you talk about you're always, you know, looking for, you know, some of the elements of design.
Yeah.
In your photos. I mean, when you looked at this, you say, ah, yes, look, there's line, there's color. I've got to take this because, or is it just that something you just see naturally and you don't even think about?
Well, these days it sort of comes almost naturally. It's like it's in my system somehow. I can, there was one case here in the Philippines. I was shooting on the beach and I had an assistant with me and he stood right next to me, 2 inches away from me. I managed to get this frame of signing boards and the sun just hit the sails just perfect. But that lasted less than 5 seconds. And he didn't see it. And he said, how can you get this? I was standing right next to you. That is sort of, I can recognize it right away. And sometimes, or a lot of times actually, I can predict images. Somebody walking down the street or I'm standing in front of the wall and I just have to say, well, okay, I just wait here. And if I'm lucky, that person in that beautiful colorful dress will walk past that nice graphic wall. I wait. And if it doesn't happen, well, then next time.
Yeah, that's a good attitude. Speaking of that, you have another photo, probably just that situation. Was in Rajasthan near Jaipur. I should be able to say that. We have a restaurant near us with Jaipur Junction. But it's a lady with a red cape on.
Right.
Walking past the wall with yellow windows and dark streaks, dark vertical streaks on the wall. And again, you know, it must be one of those timing things, but I mean, just the composition and, you know, in those yellow windows between the lines.
Right.
Most people probably would have walked right past that spot.
I need to find it. Which one it is? What?
It's
Portfolio collection.
Correct. Yeah, portfolio collection.
Which one is down? You have four links there, so I can have a quick look.
The last characters in the URL are NEKIV4.
Okay, I got it.
That helps.
Yeah, I got it. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Picked a very good one, actually.
Hey, you're making me feel better about my taste. I appreciate that.
Very, very good. Actually, you picked a very good one, a classic, actually. Makes me happy, too. So. No, this one, again, it was very, it's quite about 60 kilometers from Jaipur. It's a Salt Lake area. There's no tourists. You don't see anybody. And I was on my own. I traveled there and just to always scouting around and I saw this wall, but of course there was something missing. The wall alone would have been nice already as a graphic element, but behind me there was a water pump, which obviously was the village water pump where people get their drinking water. So I decided, so, well, if I hang around here long enough, there's meant to be some people coming by. And sure enough, I saw her coming and I was just hoping she didn't walk behind me. She walked right past past this wall, and sure enough, it happened. That was one of these cases where I physically waited. And that was the end of that's the outcome of that image.
And had she not come along, would you have come back to that spot again?
Maybe not. Depends sometimes. Sometimes you can get back to these. I tried this a few times, but then you really go back to these places and try to recreate something which is in your mind. But many times that doesn't work out. So I guess a little bit of luck is involved. But I do go back occasionally. I do one particular area in Colombo, in Sri Lanka. I keep going back to the same place. And somehow in that particular spot, I can recreate over and over again. So But in this area, I'm not sure.
That's just, I mean, it's just such a cool spot that, of course, you probably just have thousands of places like that in that part of the world, I'm sure.
The real key is if you recognize something as being very interesting, then the next step is, I guess, to isolate. I'm very good at isolating subjects. I don't like it being too cluttered. I like to keep it clean. It's always been like that with me. So I don't like it too cluttered and you don't even know what's going on anymore. Again, it comes back to that graphic element which I have into my... which is in my system, I guess.
I know. For me, I think you were talking about, you know, you have to learn how to see. And I know myself as a struggling photographer, that's something I struggle with all the time. And it's so hard to tune everything else out and zero in on something when you're looking at the whole scene. And, I mean, how do you do that? Or, again, is it just something you just learn over time?
Well, I think it's more discipline, it's more patience than anything. It's some. I take chances. I sometimes wait 45 minutes, sometimes I wait an hour. And, of course, that is difficult to do if you're with a group. I usually do that when I'm on my own, then I have all the time in the world.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's like, well, after 1 hour, then I say, okay, nothing is going to happen. And then you walk away, and 2 seconds later, it did happen. And say, well, if I would have waited another minute or so, I could have got it. But it's at the time, it's your gut feeling. It's it's almost like an instinct. I'm sure something is going to happen. And many times in my case, it does. But I pick areas where you can almost predict it. And then you just have to wait.
And again, that just comes with experience, I'm sure.
Absolutely. That is, I mean, 35 years experience comes in handy.
Yeah, it does. It does. I've got another photo here that really jumped out at me. I think this was part of the LX100 review you did. A trumpet player in Singapore.
Oh, yeah, that's a cool one. Yeah, well, I actually was taking the Lumix they gave me the Lumix pretty much that morning in Singapore, and it just came, just arrived. It hadn't even been released at the time. And I didn't even look at the manual. Normally I do that. I recommend that even for my students to read their camera manual. But since I used Lumix, so I thought it's not that difficult. Anyway, I took a small group there, which during the launch, we did some street walks, and as we walk along in Singapore, not far from where the event was held, we just walked along, and I saw this trumpet player, which was actually a nice wall, which was orangey, and they had, obviously, it was a bar inside somewhere, and this trumpet player was cut out of foil and was stuck on there, so... By getting the right, on the left of that was really cluttered and ugly. So I managed to frame it in such a way that it's turned out to be almost like a 3D real trumpet player. And what did make the difference is the wall, the turquoise, which complements the orange very well, actually, was a stone pillow. And, of course, I brought that in. Somebody else would have maybe just shot the trumpet player, but adding that pillow added that 3D effect to it and gave it some depth.
Yeah, it sure did. At first, I thought it was a real person.
Yeah, people say that it's a real thing, but it's a cutout foil which stuck on the wall, and there's some advertisements on the left. And the area is very cluttered on the left, so it was very tricky, actually, to isolate that and make it clean.
Yeah, well, you sure did that. Yeah, because that caught my eye the other day when we were laying out the issue, and then I was glad to see it in here. So I thought, well, yeah, we have to include this in our discussion. All right. Well, I do have to ask you about at least one more. I mean, there's so many, and this is in Jaipur again. It's called Walk into Light. It's a lady in a corridor.
Oh, yeah. Wow. You picked some very...
Hey.
Wow. Good choice. You picked up some good ones.
Yeah. Well, this... I mean, it's just such a beautiful photograph. And what... One of the... I mean, I jotted some notes when I saw this, you know, that's a tough... It looks like it's a tough place to photograph, you know. It's real dark in the foreground. It's very light in the background where she is. And I was thinking, oh, if I shot that, and you'd have to do it quickly, right, to catch her in the right place.
Yeah.
If I shot that, I probably would have blown out the highlights and tried to fix it in post. But I, you know, obviously you caught it in camera, exposed just properly.
And the original just looks like that. It's some little bit of post processing in that, but almost nothing.
Mm-hmm.
The original is just like that. But interesting you picked this. This is actually, we just talked about it. This is the case where I tried to redo it. I was in that same corridor the year or 2 years before, and I was trying to do the same thing, and I couldn't get it. And this time around, I was there again. I said, no, I don't care. I'm going to go to the same corridor. I knew where it was and try, maybe I get it this time. The problem is these shots are very difficult, so I had time to work on my lighting, so that was relatively easy to do. And I was standing in a corridor, but the problem is there are so many tourists walking in and out, and even local tourists, Indians alike and foreigners, so it's a never-ending traffic. And the sooner you think you have something, it's spoiled by somebody coming around the corner. So I hung around there for about 35 to 40 minutes. Hello, you still there?
Oh, I'm here. I'm just listening to you.
Okay. So I hung around there for about 45 minutes, and all of a sudden I've seen that woman before sweeping outside in the courtyard. And I didn't hoping that she was going to walk in, but I was waiting for anybody in a sari actually to walk in. So I knew... Tourists, the Indian tourists go there too. If one woman walked by in a sari, I would have been happy. But then all of a sudden, this lady was doing the sweeping, walked into the entrance, as you can see where the light is, and I said, wow. And I got 3 frames and that was it. And then the tourists, then somebody else came along in the corridor and spoiled it again. But I had time actually. I had it preset. I was ready. But I had to wait. And it was very hot.
Well, it was worth the wait.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's interesting. So you had been there, and you knew you wanted to shoot in that location, so you went back and just waited.
Yeah.
And you had the exposure all set. So would you have shot this in manual or?
No, what I normally do is 90% of the time, I do shoot manual,
mm-hmm.
but 90% of the time what I do is shoot on... aperture priority. I mm-hmm. like to be in control of my aperture.
Ouch. That's quite a ring you've got there.
Yeah, it's finished now.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. I like to shoot aperture priority myself. But, you know.
I do shoot manual a lot. But, you know, when you want to be ready, particularly when you walk around, I need to be quick sometimes, so I have it preset. I have a presetting. So I usually walk out of the hotel or jump out the car. I usually have my ISO at 200 these days. And then on my aperture usually sits on 5.6, so I can get it. Mm-hmm. Even there's movement, I can react very fast. Now, if I have time, then I start messing around maybe with more depth of field or bring down the ISO.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, especially if you're using a Micro Four Thirds, you're going to get plenty of depth of field at 5.6. So, all right, I've got one more question for you. I mean, one thing we didn't really talk about in here are a lot of your portraits. You do a lot of really compelling portraits, street portraits of people. And I had a few in here, but we're not going to have time to get to all of them. But it seems like you really are good at engaging with your subjects. I mean, a lot of people shoot on the street and they're, you know, they're just taking candid shots of people, but you, looks like you're actually talking to them and engaging with them. Is
well,
that true?
Yeah, I do engage a lot. And I think, actually, that's where a small camera comes in. What I mentioned earlier comes in very handy. You know, if people see you walking there with two big bodies, two DSLRs with big artillery pieces on it, they'll say already, uh-oh, here we go, here comes a guy. You know, okay, you can shoot it with a long lens and might get him off guard, but I like to get personal. And it doesn't work always. Sometimes they don't like it, or I have to hang around there for a while, or I have to engage them in a conversation.
So do you speak the language?
No, sometimes it's hands and feet.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only way, you know.
Yeah, yep, I think. Most people appreciate it when others, you know, try to communicate with them or attempt to use their language. So, all right. Well, Gunther, I'm sorry I've kept you so long, but it's, you know, your stories are just fascinating. And real quick, where can people find out more about you?
On my website.
And
on my blog.
That's right.
And actually, on my main website, there's links straight away to my photo shelter site, or on the and that leads also to the photo workshops.
Well, we're gonna we'll include links to all of those places in
websites.
The article, and particularly the website. Are you very active on Flickr or?
No, I'm not. I'm on Facebook. Facebook, I guess everybody, unfortunately, is a necessary evil, as I call it.
Yeah,
you need to be part of that. Flickr, I'm not hot on. It's basically Instagram. I do some on Instagram. I do some on Twitter and, of course, Facebook.
Okay, well, we'll make sure that we've got links to all of those. And one other thing, you've been so many places and shot in so many places. What's your favorite? If there's one thing that all of us, one place that all of us need to go to photograph, where is it?
I was waiting for that question.
Oh, you were? Okay.
I was really waiting for that. I get asked that question all the time. There is really... To be honest, there's really not a single favorite. But if you really want to, if you want me to name some, I mean, give an example, Myanmar would be definitely a place to go now before it gets too modernized. I love Cambodia, but one trip to Cambodia to Angkor Wat is not going to do it. You need to know Cambodia, so multiple visits can make a difference. India is definitely one place where you're never going to run out of subjects. But again, India is such a big continent that I've been there many times. And every time I go there, I try to pick another area. But it's just amazing. It's just amazing. In my opinion, if you're seriously into photography, once in your lifetime, you need to go to India.
That's certainly on my list. Well, Gunther, hey, thank you again. Really appreciate the time, and I hope you can come back with us again. Wish you well on your next trip, and like I said, I can't thank you enough for being with us today.
Thank you very much, too, Bob. I appreciate it, and you have a wonderful day, too, over there, even though you're snowed under.
Yeah, it's just life in the Great White North.